Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Professor Stephen Mosier. Mosier is a graduate of the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, where he received degrees in physical education and sports studies. He is currently a professor of sports management and media at Ithaca College. He has taught and written about all aspects of sport, including philosophical perspectives, the history of sport, sport and film literature and popular culture, the Olympic Games, youth sport in American culture as well. And welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Now, I always have to begin from the beginning, if I can. What made you go into sports management and teaching this?
Yes.
Were you an athlete?
I was a jack-of-all-trades athlete trapped in a very small body. There was no way I was going to be able to achieve what it was that I wished to be, which was the center fielder for the Boston Red Sox. And so when, you know, at 18 or college, escaping the Vietnam War, of course, I was also presented with a bit of a what am I going to do with the rest of my life kind of deal. And so I decided, well, if you can't do sports, you might as well write about it. So I majored in journalism and creative writing at UMass as well, aspiring to be a sports writer. But
wow.
Getting fired from three successive newspaper jobs at the lowest local level because I had a big mouth and rather strong opinions, and I assumed that when editors said this is a byline, a story, that I could write what I wanted to write, and obviously I couldn't. So
you went into teaching.
Well, I decided after 4 years of undergraduate education that I really liked college and I needed to figure out a way to spend the rest of my life there, and I've managed to do it, shockingly.
Yeah. It's great. And this is an interesting field to me. Now, I want to talk to you about the evolution of children in sport.
Sure.
Didn't it used to be that we got kids to go into sports to build character and learn how to, you know, work together? And so, I mean, what has it evolved into now? Has it changed?
Well, certainly we believed that, and our youth sport movement in the early part of the 20th century was all about getting kids to learn teamwork, learn how to cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when youth sport first started and came out of the rugby school in England, the goal of rugby was to help feminize little boys, which in this 21st century, imagining rugby as a sport that's going to feminize male is pretty interesting.
Well, was the notion to tame them?
The notion was to tame them.
Wow.
Little boys, adolescent boys, particularly in the private schools in England, was all about survival of the fittest. There was a lot of corporal punishment. Kids beat each other up, and a lot of kids wound up dead.
Wow.
And so sport was seen as a means by which boys could be civilized. And the word that was used back then was feminization. And that idea came across the pond, as you say, to the United States of America and had to be morphed a little because our education system is public, not private, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that sport builds character, that team sports are good for us, was bought hook, line, and sinker. And when the President of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt, buys into it as well, there you go. Sports builds young men to be of good character, and most importantly, to be really good soldiers in wartime.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. God. So what's happening now? I mean, it seems like sport with adults and children is just winning is everything, and parents and coaches are fighting with each other in youth baseball. It's unbelievable.
Over the course of my lifetime, it really has changed an awful lot. When you and I think we're roughly the same age, when you and I went to school, physical education every day was part of the regimen, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Today, there's not a single state in the union that has daily physical education and fitness education as part of the curriculum. And so the whole idea of sport being good for us has become privatized. And once you take it out of the educational setting and sport becomes a commodity, then children become a commodity as well. Parents buy into this idea that somehow or another their kid is going to wind up signing that professional contract when the odds are so infinitesimally small. It makes no sense to spend that kind of money. So it's strange. We have a sports craze going on in our country right now, and we also have a national epidemic of obesity.
That's the part that just does not make sense to anybody. Yeah. What about this cheating that, you know, that in recent years, people using performance-enhancing drugs so on and so forth, it's all over the news. I mean, do you think this is a cultural thing because winning at all costs is it, or is it a leadership vacuum?
I think it might be a third alternative. I think what this problem is right now is a really large one, and that is the society is trying to apply upper middle class morality and 19th century morality onto the lives of people who, for the most part, come from incredibly desperately poor situations. And I've written about this a lot, and I've gotten in trouble a lot by offering explanations for why this particular athlete might do this, or this athlete may see this as not wrong, just simply a means to getting ahead in life. And if that's the American dream, to be able to get ahead in your life, then cheating is just one of those things you do in order to get there.
It does feel like it's become cultural.
Yeah. Oh, man,
it's really... So what do you think all this cheating and the downfall of all these heroes and stuff has done to fans? I mean, has it changed fandom in any way, do you think?
No, I think the word fan explains it all. It
fanatic,
comes from fanatic.
Yeah.
Fans are crazy. And the whole logic of sports and following sports teams is a crazy kind of environment anyway.
So fans agree with this, you know, take the drug so that we win. Do you think?
Well, it depends on the sport. You know, it really does. I mean, in bicycling with Lance Armstrong, he's part of a sport where everybody has cheated forever.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
In Major League Baseball, I don't know why the leaders seem to think it's a mortal sin, but you get caught, you do a 50-game suspension. In the National Football League, if you get caught, you do a one-game suspension. So the slippery slope of moral relativism is alive and well in the world of sports. And for the most part, most fans are smart enough to not be able to think that somehow or another the corruption of sport is also going to corrupt them.
Yeah.
People tend to be fairly solid about separating the sport world from the rest of their lives.
Well, what do you think about all the multimillion-dollar, you know, sponsorships that athletes are constantly getting? Especially the elite ones. Has that changed sport? I mean, it wasn't always this way, was it?
It wasn't always this way, but hustling for the fast buck has always been part of the entertainment world, and certainly spectator sports is part of the entertainment world. What I find fascinating is that this insistence that somehow or another sport makes us better people morally is just flies in the face of rational thinking. We don't ask our actors and our actresses to be role models for us. We certainly don't ask lawyers and stock people to be our role models. That would be a bad thing. Somehow or another, this insistence that sports is good for us stays and just never going to go away as far as I can see.
Even with the downfalls of all these people, it probably
the downfalls tend to prove the point. You know, cautionary tales. If you do this, you're going to wind up, you know, in jail, or you're going to let down the country. One of the really good things is that while we're talking about sport, and certainly my entire professional life is based around the sport culture and studying the sport culture, the vast majority of people in the United States of America really don't care about sports. They're doing something else on Sunday afternoon, and it's not watching the football games. It's mowing the grass, taking care of the kids, doing what life throws.
But you wouldn't know
them.
That if you were turning on the stations on the weekends,
because
it's permeated by football. Even the national news gets preempted by it.
It's true. It's very strange how that happens. But certainly since the advent of ESPN in the late 1970s, the whole media and mediating of sports phenomenon has changed to the point where you only have to have an audience of a couple of 100,000 people, and you're great, because the demographics are so understood that the advertisers can target that specific product to that particular clientele, and as long as it continues to make money for the people who are producing these events, then we're in good shape. We'll just keep doing it.
You know what I've always wanted to know? Do sponsors have control over athletes that they give these huge bundles of money to at all?
Some of them do. I mean, the contracts are pretty airtight, and there are morals clauses in almost all of them. But Nike has never, ever really fired any athlete before Lance Armstrong. They've sort of let them slide away. But
why do you suppose they did that with Lance Armstrong?
I think that the betrayal that Lance Armstrong committed, and it wasn't the betrayal of bike fans, it was this notion that somehow or another the fiction that was created around him surviving cancer and doing all of these great life works for the Livestrong Foundation, It was so shocking because people had invested so much of themselves into that idea. It reminds me a lot of the pink ribbon campaigns for breast cancer that sports have also grabbed a hold of. And, you know, for the 30 years that the pink ribbons have been around, women's breast cancer incidences haven't changed at all.
Yeah.
So somebody's making money. And there may be some research that's being done that's effective, but you're not seeing it at the end.
All those campaigns are just regurgitating each other and paying each other off and paying.
Yeah.
I know, you can be cynical about all that.
Well,
cynical. I certainly can, too.
I think one of the most important functions of a college professor is to adopt that role of cynicism and skepticism. I tell my students from day one, I don't hide anything about this, is that if a teacher is doing his or her job correctly, then the teacher is always engaging in an act of sedition. Teaching is always challenging the status quo. And the kids can...
And trying to get these kids to think, too.
Not
just give them pablum to swallow without questioning everything.
Yes. Yeah. So my history of sport class, it's not about sports. It's about how, the race, class, and gender dynamics of the last 150, 200 years in the United States of America particularly have been played out in the world of sports. And in the world of war, and in the world of politics, and one of my favorites, in the world of popular music. So when all four of those things come together at the same time, you wind up with a rather amazingly powerful cultural product.
Yeah. Most sports teams and sports leagues, and I mean, they're so into statistics and records and stuff. How do we account for that now that Barry Bonds beat Hank Aaron and we think it's because he took drugs? What has that done to statistics and all those numbers that everybody's always bragging about they know about their teams?
Right. Personally, between you and me, I don't get
it. And my audience.
And your audience. I don't get the obsession with statistics. I mean, the whole field of sabermetrics in baseball, I'm really not interested myself in that, but certainly a lot of people
are.
And I think it has a lot to do with these fantasy leagues and gambling so that people who have rather mundane lives can at least escape for a while into thinking that they're in control. And if you can attach numbers to it, at least in our capitalist society, then those statistics become even more valid and those beliefs become more valid.
I know, they feel like they're building a whole story around them in some ways, because it seems like they have statistics for every time anybody breathes in baseball,
Absolutely. When I was growing up, the manager of a baseball team usually took a nap during the game, and now if they're not looking at a notebook, they're looking at some computer screen saying, okay, I got to call this pitch because it's two outs in the bottom of the sixth, and a left-handed pitcher is pitching against a right-handed batter who likes to go up the middle on 0-2 counts, and it's just like, where's the magic? That's, for me, it's robbed the sport of the magic, and that's always been the thing that I loved about sports.
You know what I want to ask you, too, before we go on with some of the stuff that you've studied? What kind of people go into sport management now? What kind of students are you getting, though? Are they interested in actually managing sports, or...
Yeah, sport management and media, yes. What do our students, why do they go in there? Well, I think it's because they love sports. They know that there are lots and lots of jobs behind the scenes. They know that at 18, they're not going to be a professional athlete, much like I decided I wanted to be a sports writer. So, yeah, you can still be a sports writer if you want, except that there aren't any newspapers. So you have to learn how to write your stories for sports information, or you have to blog, or you have to do webcasting, all this other stuff. And we have professors who train kids to do that. But what I like to get is that cross-section of students who want to be athletic trainers or physical therapists and think they want to work with athletes as clients. And I get the students from the Park School of Communications who want to be either on-air talent or behind-the-screen talent, and help them to understand that if they're going to go into the world of sport, understanding the cultural part of it is and the sociological part of it is absolutely essential. And it's no secret that, to me, that one of the reasons why ESPN is so successful is that last time I checked, about 20% of the people who work in Bristol came out of our college.
Wow.
And only one of them is on the air.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Professor Stephen Mosier. He's a professor of sports management and media at Ithaca College. Listen, I want to talk to you about the Olympics, because you've written quite a few articles about the Olympics. How important are they politically in this global culture now? Can you talk to us about the evolution?
Well, if you're an emerging nation, they're absolutely essential to getting
you're one or two people into the Olympics, right?
Getting your best free advertisement to the rest of the world. So the next Summer Olympics, which will be held in Brazil, the idea that somehow or another Brazil is just an emerging nation is preposterous to me, just as people who thought somehow or another Beijing, China was an emerging nation aren't paying any attention to the global economy and politics. But within the people who consume the Olympic Games, and that is mostly Western Europeans and North Americans through television, Brazil is probably still considered a third world, and China is still considered, you know, behind the Iron Curtain kind of country. Mm-hmm. So the idea of being able to use sport to fight our wars and to show our system of government and our way of life is better than your way of life is a powerful, powerful mythology that the International Olympic Committee is very much aware of and plays very, very well.
Do you think people being able to root for their countries in such a fanatic way is maybe better than them doing it on war zones? I mean, does it help let out some tensions, do you think?
Certainly cheering for your beach volleyball team is better than shooting guns at each other. But
do you think it does let off some steam for some people who might rather cheer for their country on a war theater?
Certainly for some people, but if you want me to say that the research shows that, you know, the release of hostilities is helpful by watching a sporting event, I'm not going to say that. You can believe it, and a lot of people do, but it's not substantiated by the research.
Is that so? Because it's still a myth that goes around all over the place, even in schools.
Oh, yes, absolutely, absolutely. For a very small group of kids who are high-stimulus need kids, mostly boys, sports can be an avenue to release all those hostile aggressions. But for most everyone else, it either has very little effect or it could even be dangerous. So, you know, I have adolescent grandchildren who spend way too much time playing video games where, you know, while certainly playing Call of Duty or Mortal Kombat is not going to turn you into a murderer, there's enough research to suggest that it helps desensitize kids to their inner feelings of empathy and compassion that I just don't think they're good for anybody to play, even if it's really good hand-eye coordination stuff.
Yeah, that's what we were told in the beginning, that it helped with that.
Yeah.
Now, you've written a lot about Leni Riefenstahl's famous, or infamous, I suppose, film Olympia. Well, where do we place that now in the 21st century? Was it just a piece of propaganda, or was it really a beautiful piece of art? And what do you think?
Well, I've thought a lot about this for about 40 years, and I still use the film in my classes. Well, certainly Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will is considered by many to be the greatest propaganda film ever made. Mm-hmm. Olympia is far more difficult to get at. If you look at the 6 hours over and over again like I have, I think the theme that comes out is an appeal to the Ayn Randian objectivistic kind of worldview. And ultimately, I think that's why Olympia, while beautiful to look at, it appears almost like it's voyeurism at its best.
I've seen parts of it, yeah.
There's no moral core to this film, and I don't think a work of art can survive the test of time. As brilliant as this may be technically, and it is just, for the time, stunning.
Yeah.
It just, there's nothing behind the beauty.
Well, I was thinking that it almost looks fictionalized, like what we were talking about before, the fictionalized version of sports and these guys' lives.
Yeah. Well, it's crystal clear that many of the practices and cult symbols that the IOC has adopted over the 20th century came directly out of this film. The torch run is an invention of the Nazis. The Olympic bell, the salute of the Olympic game is so close to the Nazi salute that I wouldn't want to have anything to do with it myself if I were the IOC, but they hang on to it.
Yeah.
There's this compulsion to do this, we who are about to die salute you kind of thing in the Olympic Games. And while we, as spectators, tend to project ourselves onto the lives of people who will give everything to cross that finish line, whether winning or losing, there's something dangerous in that. I mean, there's a lot to be said for being moderate at times.
I wanted to ask you this, too. In regard to men's and women's sports, they're still not equitable. Do you think they ever will be? I mean, obviously, women don't get paid as much in golf, for instance. And they don't get as much airtime, certainly.
Certainly. Wow. This is a tough one for me. I don't think that, and I say this to all of my students when I teach this kind of a unit in my classes, I'm just the messenger. Don't for a second think that I believe this. I certainly subscribe to the notion that women are human as much as men are human. But as long as our society continues to insist on having women play games that were devised by men, invented by men to exploit men's physiologies, then women are always going to be really lousy at being men, just as men are going to be really lousy at being women. When you look at the sports...
Yeah, but you don't... I mean, is there a really difference, though, between men and women in regard to golf? It's not some big...
Of course there is.
I know, but it doesn't have that much to do with strength, does it? It seems like it's more of a mental game.
You could say that, but when you get up to the elite levels, yes, the strength overwhelms everything when everything else is equal. Just as if we were to have, say, an endurance test, because quite clearly women are much better at the greatest endurance test than men because they live longer. But put women in the ocean and put men in the ocean and tell them to swim 300 miles, women are going to win that race every single time. Mm-hmm. All of the long-distance open water swimming records are held by women. Just as if you would ask women to run across the United States of America, there's actually a race called the Race Across America. Mm-hmm. Women perform wonderfully in that because endurance becomes the absolute key factor between winning and losing. Hand-eye coordination sports.
Yeah, but what does this have to do with the money difference and the coverage? Because people still want to watch women athletes and men athletes.
Most people who watch sports are men. It's just that simple. The only way they're going to watch women playing sports is if they're half naked, like in beach volleyball, or they are overtly over heterosexually presented to the audience.
You're saying it's a man's world, and that's why we have these inequalities still, right?
Yes.
So especially in regard to athletics.
Right. But when you look at the Olympic Games, the programming for the Olympic Games in the United States of America is geared toward 35 to 60-year-old women, which is why you get to see all the gymnastics and all the ice skating and all the human interest stories in between.
See, that's the stuff I cannot stand.
Well...
I'm in the right demographic, but I'm not bought off by that.
Well, most moms and grandmas are, and as long as most of them who are watching are persuaded by it, then you're going to have to be satisfied with switching the channel.
Turn on the remote and go get myself another glass of wine.
Yes. That's great.
What do you think the Penn State, you know, the incredible controversy around the Sandusky thing is going to do for sports? Anything?
No, I don't think it'll do a thing. I have pointed out to my students over the last year and a half that the Penn State culture was so wrapped up around Joe Paterno and this mythology that was created over the last 30 years that the idea that a college would allow, and Joe Paterno hired this woman, allow a coach to have a policy on her basketball team that no lesbians are allowed in her locker room or on her team. And Renee Portland was allowed to work at Penn State for 30 years before she was finally dismissed. There's something really profoundly disturbing about a culture that is so wrapped up in testosterone and willingly looking the other way simply because seven Saturdays a year people get to tailgate, get drunk, and party.
Well, you know, it just became infamous because of Penn State, but it permeates so many universities and colleges, right? This sports fanaticism at the expense of almost everything else. What do you think about that? Can that change? Should it?
Should it change? Yes. Yeah. Can it change? Only with the collective will of the people who run the NCAA, which supposedly are the college presidents, but I don't see that happening because the perception that somehow or another you make a lot of money playing Division I college sports is still there, even though the research is quite clear. You lose money hand over fist. Nobody makes money outside of maybe 12 to 15 colleges, and it's all the football and the men's basketball team that makes the money and then pays for everything else, which I guess is why they're allowed to continue to do what they do, which is essentially ignore what it means to be a college student.
That seems to be the case.
That's right. You're preparing for an athletic career, and when the return rate on auditioning for the athletic career is 1 in 1,000 make it to the pros, most college journalism departments or art departments would go out of business if their return rate was so terrible.
That's a good point.
Yeah. So economically, it doesn't make sense by any stretch of the imagination, but it's really, really difficult to measure the cultural capital that comes along with that. So people love to say, we are Penn State. When I was 18, I bought it, but that was a long time ago, and I grew up. Some people don't want to grow up.
Maybe that's part of the whole mythology around sports. Maybe that is the reason, one of them at least.
Certainly, I think that's exactly what it is.
Wow.
Yeah.
Tell me about this story. You've written about sport in regard to the civil rights movement. Well, what's the correlation? I'm not quite sure what you were driving at.
Well, as a child of the 60s myself, there was this one brief moment in time when sport was seen as the avenue and the most efficient avenue to help desegregate the United States of America.
Mm.
So the mythology of Jackie Robinson and bringing African American students into colleges, particularly in the South, is seen as a great step forward. And all of this happened post-World War II up until, by 1970, it was a fait accompli. And, of course, in 1970, that's when women were acknowledged as also being human. Civil rights movement, with Title IX, the civil rights movement really was played out on the sport fields of high schools, professional sports, and colleges. And so when Tommy Smith and John Carlos, they weren't the first athletes to make a political statement at the Olympic Games, just the most famous in the eyes of American viewers. That's an extraordinarily brave act to do when they have seen every African-American leader or even white leaders who sympathized with African-American progressive causes wind up getting assassinated.
Oh, yeah. Well, Steve Mosher, we're almost out of time. Can you tell, are you working on any articles or books that we might be able to partake of in the future?
Well, hopefully it'll be in Barnes & Noble, not in some academic textbook store, because I would like to have an audience more than four reading it. But for the past 4 years, I've been engaged in an autoethnography of my own bowling life. I bowled when I was younger, and I bowled in college, and then family obligations got in the way. And it's only in the past 5 or 6 years that I've actually, when we moved to Cortland from Ithaca, yes, people, you heard that. We moved from Ithaca to Cortland. My wife works at SUNY Cortland, and I joined bowling leagues. And I am discovering just how much of Robert Putnam's idea that there's no longer any community-based life out there, that we all live in our single cells, is just simply not true. Bowling may be a dying sport, but it's a sport you can do while you're drinking. I'm in support of that. But I also have met so many friends doing that.
Oh, that's great. Well, we'll look forward to that. That sounds fascinating to me. Bowling is a great community. I did it when I was a kid. Stephen Mosher, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.